everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer. I am joined by my co-hosts, Magic Mike.
What's up?
And Magic Jesus, apparently, this week, as Matt is rocking his hairstyle from the GP update rather than how he looks today.
Hey, how's it going?
That seems unfair on our weekend, frankly.
Gets to rock a no camera and you have to rock a camera?
No, you can't use a GP Top 8 picture coming off a combined...
Oh, Owen's whatever record.
Yeah, I don't think any of us want a match.
No, we did not. I don't know. I feel like I just want to be immortalized in that time frame, so I think it's fine.
That's just how you want to be remembered throughout your life. I can understand that. That makes a lot of sense. You know what makes a lot of sense, though, is shopping at our sponsor, Oasis Games. You can check them out at mvgoasis.com. You can get 15% off of your order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. You can get 4% off of every order by using the code WouldThatBeGood. That's CCMTG and WouldThatBeGood. You know, Oasis is amazing, but you know who else is amazing? There's our other sponsor at In Gaming. You can use the code CCMTG10 there. You can get your sleeves, your playmat, your deck boxes, everything that you need to show up and not have your cards and your stuff get ruined, because, no, let's be honest. If you play Magic like Danny Cathro, then you probably should use sleeves and a playmat. Just thinking out loud here.
As opposed to people who don't play Magic like Danny Cathro and don't need sleeves on a playmat?
I'm just saying that some people are more violent on their cards than others.
I think playmats are very important if you don't change your sleeves often.
Oh, that's definitely true. If you think about... this is something that I know about my friends who, like, change their sleeves for every event versus those who don't, is that is literally the definitive line as to whether or not you use a playmat.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, your sleeves just get dirty if you don't use a playmat. That's just a fact.
Yeah, so, like, I change my sleeves, I think, once every two and a half to three events now. And that's just because I still use a playmat. I also just like the spacing at, like, Grand Prix and stuff like that. But for most of my friends, they just are like, no, I'll just pay the $10 every event and get new sleeves and call it good.
Yep.
So, but yeah, if you are looking for sleeves or playmats, don't forget to check them out at In Gaming. You can also support the podcast directly by going to patreon.com/ccmtg, become a patron of the show. Or you can check out the rest of the network. You know, support us that way. You can watch... you know, Mason sit there and talk about how great his own podcast is on his own podcast. That's an interesting thing that happens. You can listen to Brandon and Lobert, which I honestly has just become one of my favorite shows right now is Common Knowledge. Like, I actually legitimately love listening to it. It makes me excited for Popper. If you love Popper, you should check out the show. It's very good. I really love it. And then you can check out Adam at Homer Path. I mean, he had probably his best episode he's ever had this last week, and it was really fun to listen to, and you should check out everything that's going on the network. It's really cool, as well as some of the streamers going on Trophy Mages. We added two more this week. Hopefully, we'll get that churning out on YouTube so that if you're a podcast listener, you're probably not watching a ton of streams, but you might be watching VODs, and we post all those VODs to YouTube when we can. So check that out, Trophy Mages and all those other shows. But let's get into the point of this podcast. The point of this podcast is to be always improving. We want to do what we can to improve all the times ourselves. And this week is the first week that the three of us are together in... I don't know. We did episode 250. So it's our first normal episode together in a while. So I'm excited to hear about your guys' experience over the last couple of weeks about, you know, just getting better at life or Magic in general. Why don't we start with you, Matt? What have you done to improve at Magic or life this week?
Well, I spent a lot of time playing Limited this week, and mostly just got around to actually playing some Magic. I haven't played in a little bit of time now. I did a lot of thinking about the new standard format this week, and I don't know. I think we've reached some pretty sound conclusions, but it's going to be interesting to see how the format breaks out in the next few weeks and to get to test some of this stuff.
So when you think about standard, rather than, you know, doing a ton of playing of standard, what does that do for you in your Magic game? Like, What do those thoughts look like versus, like, what everybody else's thoughts look like, or maybe they're the same, but what is a productive thought session look like for you?
Well, generally when I'm thinking about Magic, I try to think of what are the best decks, first of all. The conclusion I came to in this instance is that green-black mid-range of some form is the best deck. The next question I have is there any reason not to play the best deck? And I haven't come up with a good answer for that yet, but the next question that I always follow up with is, what would I do if I was trying to beat the best deck? And we come up with a few solutions for that, like, namely, flyers. It seems like their interaction is fairly limited, so
I talked a little bit about that in my deck tech today. Just like the reason that Vivian Reed is so good is because your deck's kind of weak to flyers, and she just comes down and kills the biggest flyer on board, gets easily protected on the ground by just the vast number of creatures that you have. So I think that, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, having main deck plummets is actually really nice for that deck. And then a little bit of emphasis on trying to be able to beat Plaguecrafter and Eldest Reborn. Like, I think you need some kind of way to generate a way to sack something fairly free. Karn was one of the things that we were thinking about.
I'm excited to talk about our deck of the week this week in that specifically, so hold that thought as we get into that. What about you, Michael? What have you done to improve your Magic this week?
Kind of a lot of the same stuff. I think, you know, we spent a lot of time traveling to and from Denver, just sort of running through ideas about different decks and sort of building them in our heads and thinking about how they line up against each other. And I think as we start to see things take shape a little bit more, as you have kind of a couple of decks that are relatively established and like Jeskai, green, black, mono red, green, white tokens, like you start to see some sort of stock-ish lists rising to the surface. It becomes a little bit easier to think about cards you might want and why. And I think that it makes you more likely to start in a reasonable place when it comes to testing.
So I am on the opposite end. I've been playing a lot more Magic lately. It's funny. I decided to quit PPTQs, and now I just play more Magic. It's been a huge burden, like, lifted off of me. And my win percentage has gone significantly back up. I was starting to, like, lose a lot of Magic. And the stressors of qualifying for the Pro Tour have made me win a lot more. And now I kind of just want to go to a PPTQ, to be honest. I have no idea why it has worked this way. But so, for example, I played Magic today while my son was napping as I in between waiting for some stuff for work. And because I was on Arena, I got to play a ton of games. So my total today, I believe I lost. I went 5. So 10-3, which is just like an insane win percentage regardless. And Magic has just gotten fun for me recently. Listening to more Magic podcasts, reading more Magic articles again. So it's just been a really nice refresher deciding to end that PPTQ grind and focus more on the content and things like that. And you know, I'm getting to learn a lot about lots of different decks, different formats and things like that. So it's been really fun.
Yeah, I think that the abolishing the PPTQs will actually reignite a lot of people's sparks, and I'm hopeful for that.
Well, let's move on to before we move on, I put it in the show note with like big explanation points, because this is supposed to have happened like a month ago. So it was supposed to be announced on episode 250. So I wanted to celebrate 250 episodes of Constructive Criticism. And one of the ways that I was going to do that is to give a booster box to our longest patron, and his name is Ben. Ben already knows about this. I let him know. I'll be sending that. I'll do that when probably tomorrow morning. But so I'm going to send a booster box to a set to Ben. And then also in addition to that, we're going to just extend the contest until Seth and John joined the show. But if you are a patron of any amount for Constructive Criticism, you'll be entered into a contest, or a couple of contests. I'm going to give out another booster box. I'm going to give out a playset of any card that the winner wants in Standard, stuff like that. So go to patreon.com/ccmdg, and let's just kind of celebrate the awesome things that are happening on this podcast, the amount of time that we've done it. And I'm really excited about Magic right now, and I'm really excited to give back to some of our listeners. And I'm really excited to give back to Ben, who's been a patron since basically day one. So thank you so much to Ben. I'll shoot you that booster box tomorrow. I think I already confirmed your address, so we'll get that sent out to you. If you are a patron, though, you could ask one of the Patreon questions. So this week we have a question from one of our listeners. Michael, why don't you go ahead and read it?
It says, "While you can't eliminate obvious mistakes completely, I find I make a lot more than the average player. Things like playing the wrong land, one thing about playing another one, missing power and toughness changes, and forgetting text on cards. What are the best ways to cut down on these types of mistakes?"
So this is actually going to be a lot of our entire episode this week, because this week we're going to be talking about playing disciplined Magic. But this is actually something I suffer from a lot, and actually streaming has helped. So there are a few things that I would do. The first thing is, I believe this player that's commented happens to be an MTGO grinder, and I would recommend taking notes for your MTGO matches. It's helped me a lot, along with the streaming, and I think that when you hold yourself accountable it makes you think, like, it kind of forces you to play better, to be honest. And I that's a way that I would start. Michael?
I think the biggest thing is just kind of slowing down a little bit. Honestly, I don't know that you're ever going to eliminate those mistakes completely, but if you're doing that kind of stuff a lot, I think just sort of adding like a 1-2 count in your head almost, where you're just like, okay, if I play this, what happens? Even
right.
on things that you think of as relatively intuitive makes sense. And I think that ultimately what you're trying to do is just get in the habit of sort of making every play with some consideration.
I think that's exactly kind of where I'm trying to get to in saying that you should take notes, is that when your brain knows that you're going to be thinking about these things later, it forces you to think about them in time. And that's, I completely agree with Michael. I think that the truth is that if you don't take stock of what's happening in the moment, then you're just going to continue to make those mistakes. So it's just your job to start taking stock of those things.
I mean, additionally, you're just going to sometimes do something really dumb. That's just
yeah, life. Absolutely. Matt, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I definitely agree with your guys' points. I think that slowing down is a big one. Just, you know, doing a little sanity check after or before you make any kind of play. The other thing that I would say...
I would fail that every time, though. It can't be a sanity check. It has to be something else.
The other thing that I would say is that it's a lot easier to see your own mistakes if you're willing to be accountable for them than other people. So when this person says that they tend to make these kind of mistakes more than other people, it's probably just not true. They're probably making them at the same rate as other people, but just noticing their own more.
Sure.
I mean, that being said, the core of it is trying to, you know, make these mistakes less. And the best ways to do those are just to look things over for a second longer. That's just the only way around it. Cause it's such a broad category, right? Like,
yeah,
there are so many things that are involved in this that there's no one thing other than just, you know, making sure that what you're doing is the best thing that you could be doing.
Well, hopefully this episode helps this listener quite a bit as we look at playing more disciplined magic today. Well, no power rankings this week. They're brought to you by Ink Gaming, but we're going to let Ink Gaming sponsor our Deck of the Week segment this week, talking about the Jeskai Control deck that top-aided the PTQ this weekend online. That list is 4 Crackling Drake, 4 Teferi Hero of Dominaria, 2 Syncopate, 2 Blink of an Eye, 1 Essence Scatter, 4 Justice Strike, 4... I'll never get this right. It's Deafening Clarion, is that correct?
Yes.
4 Sinister Sabotage, and when I say never, I mean I just did. 4 Chemister's Insight, 2 Cleansing Nova, 2 Expansion Explosion, or 1 Search for Ezcanto, 26 lands with 4 Cliff Top Retreat, 4 Glacial Fortress, 3 Island, 2 Mountains, 1 Plains, 4 Sacred Foundry, 4 Steam Vents, 4 Sulfur Falls. So, let's talk about the main deck before we talk about the sideboard for a second, because, first of all, Jeskai makes a lot of sense. It probably has the best mana of all of the Teferi decks. So it makes sense that this deck is starting to creep up on what Esper was to last week, right? And honestly, I believe this put up more results than Esper in the 5-0s, if I'm not mistaken. I think it has 3 recently. But the first thing that I want to talk about is kind of something that Matt mentioned during his Always Improving moment, which is having things to sacrifice to Eldritch Reborn and Playcrafter. And Crackling Drake actually does a surprisingly good job at that, Matt. This is a take on this deck I did not expect to like.
Well, honestly, I would say that Playcrafter and the Eldritch Reborn actually look insane against this deck. It does meet the other requirement that I had, though, which is try to play flyers, and I think Crackling Drake is insane at that. Like, they're probably going to have a hard time killing it some amount of the time. I mean, again, like, you're going to be soft to Playcrafter and Eldritch Reborn, I feel, with this list, so it's...
Well, but you're
that's
less...
That's a problem you kind of have to solve, but...
So hold on. When I say that, I mean you're less soft than the other control lists, because they're only playing creatures that are... that the only way to kill them is to sacrifice, and they don't want to, because that's how they expect to end the game, whereas with Crackling Drake, it's like, okay, you can kill this, I already got my value off of it, quote-unquote. I'm happy taking the 2-for-1, and now that didn't kill my Teferi.
Right. Yeah, it's never going to be a 2-for-1, because that when they're killing it with, I mean, Plaguecrafter, they get to upgrade a body probably, and like Eldritchborn obviously has other modes. But that being said, I do agree that it's going to be. I know it draws a card. I understand that. But that being said, I do think that it's better than any list that's just playing four Teferis as win conditions, because that's just going to be really tough.
Yeah, and as somebody who's played a ton of blue-white control, I looked at the mana and was like, well, the mana makes sense as long as, Michael, you don't drop all of your check lands.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically my only real issues with this deck, my favorite part of this deck is Deafening Clarion with Crackling Drake.
Yeah.
If you're looking at ways to like actually improve your red matchups, for example, Crackling Drake has 4 toughness, which is pretty sweet. And then you can clear the board and give it lifelink all at the same time and just probably end a lot of games that way. I think your black-green matchup is probably still going to be somewhat suspect at times. My concern with all the Teferi decks is just that it's really hard to protect Teferi when you play it early.
This is not the same thing. This is not the same thing as blue-white control of last season, where when you resolved it in Teferi, it was, you know, it was almost always onto a clear board. That just kind of doesn't happen against some of these black-green decks, and even against some of the other decks. Like, there's just a lot more creatures in play, which is weird, but it's how it feels.
I'm just not sold on, like, I'm not really sold on Deafening Clarion being especially good.
Yeah.
And I think that that's maybe sort of the biggest question you have to answer with Jeskai. Just how good is Deafening Clarion? How excited about this card am I?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. That being said, I think Expansion Explosion is probably kind of great against the mid-range decks.
Tell me about that. This is a card that I'm very interested in. There's a lot of love for this card going around, so...
Well, so when I'm trying to attack a mid-range deck, especially such a value-driven one like Golgari, where it's really hard to interact with them on like any kind of a creature removal axis or even a sweeper axis, like they just get so much recursion. The way that I generally like to approach those matchups is on the stack. So if there's any kind of spell that they are going to have a hard time interacting with outside of something like Duress, I'm going to try to lean towards those kind of things. So Explosion really fits the bill there. You know, obviously it can kill some kind of threat when you get up to enough mana, but just being able to draw, you know, several cards at instant speed is just going to be really powerful in those kind of grindy matchups.
Yeah, I mean, we played a match the other day with a blue-white deck to, you know, eventually I think losing to decking. Like, we were in the kind of spot where we could have just cast Explosion for lethal.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've been in that situation a lot with blue-white control on Arena, where it's just like, and it's kind of I don't know if it was one of you had mentioned to me the Devious Cover-Ups, whatever the name of the card is, and the reason that you play that card is so that you can cycle back your one win condition back into your deck in case it gets killed. But in a lot of situations, sometimes you actually just get Vraska's Contempted, and it's like, all right, well, like, I'm going to win through this Teferi. It's the only win condition left in my deck, and something like Explosion actually just closes that game out.
It at least gives you something to draw to. It forces them to actually kill you versus just, like... It's very strange to lose a game where, like, you're never close to taking lethal damage, but you still get kind of ground out of it. Like, I wouldn't say the black-green decks are especially good at attacking. None of the creatures are really very aggressive.
None of the creatures are very good.
But they all generate... Well, they're good in different ways. They all generate so much value that... Like,
I'm not sold on Merfolk, Branchwalker, Jadelight Ranger yet. As somebody who like plays a ton of the of those style of decks, those cards just have kind of felt mopey to me. I also think that it's interesting because the builds vary so wildly differently that I actually think that's what causes a lot of the problems for both decks like this Jeskai deck, and then other control decks at large.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge boon for the black-green archetype as a whole. It's just that, like, you don't actually know what you're playing against. I mean, we've seen new decks cropping up with actually no edicts, and then in the most recent match that Michael and I played with blue-white control against Golgari midrange, we got Plaguecraftered, I think, 9 times in the first game.
I was playing blue-white on stream the other day, and I got the rat, the one rat, Yeah, I got Burglar Rat like 9 times, and I was like, I just actually can't beat this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I think that, like, the matchup might become better for Jeskai if Black Rain coalesces on a single build a little bit more. But part of the thing that I would say that is going to make it tough to play control week to week in this format is that there is so much space for maneuvering within, like, the Black-Green macro archetype that I think a lot of, to me, it looks like a lot of the Black-Green decisions come down to personal preference. I don't know that you can, like, look at these lists like more plate crafters or less plate crafters or a lot of Eldest Reborns or zero Eldest Reborns and necessarily say, oh, this is just correct. It's like, I can see pros and cons to building it a bunch of different ways.
I'd like to talk really quickly, if we can, about the sideboard. We have 2 Disdainful Stroke, 4 Lava Coil, 3 Negate. Before I keep going, it sounds like Matt wants to say something really quick, though.
No, I just said definitely.
That's oh, okay. Cool. We have 1 Invoke the Divine, 2 Lyra, 1 Ral Zarek, and 2 Niv-Mizzet. So there's a few things that I have a ton of thoughts of around this deck. So first of all, the fact that this deck did well at a PTQ is really big for my brain. Like, I look at this list and I think I'm seeing a ton of things that I didn't think of doing that make a lot of sense. And also getting away from the Knight Package sideboard that I think is just correct in blue-white is really, really powerful. And I think Jeskai really offers you that in a pretty meaningful way, especially because of Crackling Drake. And I'm kind of excited to try this out. And to try different things for this sideboard. You know, this color combination itself actually has pretty good sideboard cards, Matt. Like, Disdainful Stroke is super powerful. You know, being able to play any sweepers that you want in the whole metagame other than Ritual of Soot is just... That's a big game depending on how the format shakes out. And, you know, like we said earlier, right now it doesn't seem great because there's 17 different archetypes within Green-Black itself. That's a little bit of hyperbole, but... Matt, how excited are you about trying different things in this color combination after you see a deck like this? You know, I think did it take 2nd? I actually didn't look.
No, it took 5th.
It took 5th. Okay, so it was the top performing of the first round losers.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty excited to try some of these things. Like, I certainly wouldn't build the deck like this, but I do like a lot of the things that are happening here. Especially things that we're looking at with the sideboard, like Disdainful Stroke, I've actually just been happy with in basically every match. Like, even against Mono Red, the only card that I care about is the Frenzy anyway. and Lava Coil seems completely insane against the Golgari decks, so I'm super into that.
The numbers of Justice Strike were interesting to me. I would expect that there is some flexibility between your main deck and sideboard slots just because of that. And I'm excited to just try different things due to this deck doing well that I wasn't excited to try maybe even yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that this format is incredibly diverse and open and nobody has anything really figured out yet. Black-Green is certainly the front runner right now. But that being said,
it
doesn't mean
it's a little exploitable, though, right? I mean, the Black-Green deck is really good on a certain axis, but it's pretty linear in its own sort of weird way.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like something that would be exploitable, but, I mean, obviously, you know, myself and most people have not figured that out yet.
And also, just to kind of note something that we didn't mention in the main deck, there's only 1 land in this entire deck that doesn't cast Crackling Drake.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I think that the 1 of Planes is actually terrible. I would never play that.
Would you consider making it
No, I would not play a Field of Ruin.
I was just going to say, I also wouldn't play the Field of Ruin. I might make it a Mountain. And I might consider even playing 1-2 Shivan Fires in this 75. But
might just play the 5th Sacred Foundry and see how far that gets me.
That won't work out well. You'll be the next Dan Lavender. with a weird number of lands in your deck. So I think that this deck, just kind of in general, I think that the key cards that we kind of mentioned to look out for with this archetype is Crackling Drake, the right creature to be playing in your control decks. You know, people have talked about things like Lyra. They've talked about... I personally don't like the Esper builds, so like, I did a deck tech on blue-white where I was talking about the blue dinosaur just a couple days ago. So I think that Crackling Drake is an interesting innovation into the blue-white shell itself, and it's exciting to see stuff. I mean, you have Michael getting excited about Deafening Clarion. You have Matt getting, you know, hung up on a planes that, you know, and...
Well, it's interesting. Sure, actually, the other Jeskai list, if you look, actually did cut that planes, but it was cut for a Field of Ruin.
Sure. They also just want, they really don't want, yeah, and they're playing two Niv-Mizzets in the main deck. There's just no way you can do that.
Yeah, Niv-Mizzet's a card that's also impressed me quite a bit. I don't know about you guys, but I thought this card was pretty terrible reading it, and oh my gosh, it's way better than terrible.
It is good against everything except black-green, where it is terrible does not do it justice.
Yeah, that's true.
I think if you wanted to look at working on this deck going forward, the biggest thing I would say is that I think playing 4 Justice Strikes main and 4 Lava Coil sideboard is... I think playing 8 total of that effect between main and side is
too many. I completely
agree.
And
you should probably have some Lava Coils in the main deck, if nothing else, just to free up sideboard slots.
And also, I think that Syncopate, as somebody who's been playing a ton of control, is actually just at an all-time high right now, and I would also consider playing a third one of those in the main.
Yeah, I'm just 100% certain that...
Yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying.
Justice Strikes is too many.
Too many, yeah, I agree. All right, well, let's move on from that, unless you have anything else to say, Matt.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this is a little bit off-topic, but the Legion War Bosses in the sideboard of the other list actually do look...
Spicy.
I mean, maybe that's the way that you can
beat Green-Black. That could be an interesting way to do that.
It's a way to attack that for sure. It's all about leveling, right?
Well,
it's
good
until your opponent knows you're doing it, and then it becomes a lot less good.
Yeah, I mean, if you could board in... this is actually one of the things that I've had success with Blue-White, because I'm playing that 9 package against Green-Black, is that I have tons of things to sacrifice, so my Teferis live. So if...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, we were playing... The Blue-White list that we were playing was actually playing the Knight package in the main deck. And it often still did not feel like enough creatures to sacrifice.
Sometimes it's not. I legitimately have lost still to Eldritch Reborn because it's still not enough stuff. Like, they have so many things to kill your things. It's really tough, especially if they're playing the 4 Assassin's Trophy main. They, like, actually kill your enchantment, and you're like, actually, big deal because I don't actually... I actually wanted that knight.
Yeah, maybe Vraska will do that, too.
Baby Vraska does the same thing, actually, like, comes down and kills the enchantment right away while living, so.
Yeah, both of the Vraskas and Vivian Reed all kill History of Benalia.
Yeah. So, it's an interesting time to be a control player in this meta. I would start with this list, as that's why I selected it for the show, over something like Esper. I would, you know, try and figure this out. I think this deck has the best mana for a control deck, and once the lists come closer together, once there's a clear Boros list, once there's a clear green-black list, I think that this is how control gets a little bit better. And I think we're kind of all feeling that for blue-white. Or are you guys liking Esper or blue-white a little bit better?
I like the blue-white list that we played. I thought it was actually... It made a lot of sense to play the Histories and the Knight of Graces in the main deck.
Sure.
As far as Esper, I can't imagine that the mana is very good. I think that the Jeskai mana is significantly better, and that's hard to understate.
Yeah, I think so too.
Hard to overstate, rather.
Well, let's move on to our training grounds. This week, we're going to talk about playing disciplined Magic, because, you know, we talk about the little things a lot on this show. We talk about doing the right things as often as you can, but the truth is that you can listen to this podcast 1,000 times, but if you don't play disciplined Magic, it's not going to matter. You're just going to end up kind of remembering this sometimes and sometimes not, and, you know, it's tough. So, as we did on old episodes of this show, I'm going to talk about self-discipline for a minute, and the definition of self-discipline is the ability to control one's feelings and overcome one's weaknesses, the ability to pursue what one thinks is right rather than the temptation to abandon it. Oh my gosh, did we just talk, like... That whole thing can encapsulate bad mulligan decisions in a nutshell, Michael.
Yeah, I think that when I think about playing with discipline, what I'm trying to do is remain unemotional. Like, you'll look at a 7 and know that it's a mulligan, but maybe you have, like, trying to kind of separate math from feelings when we're playing parts of the game that don't involve reading our opponent at all. Like, just being disciplined in terms of, like, I'm not going to keep a one lander on the play on 7. I'm not going to, like, just having some, they don't necessarily, hard, not necessarily hard and fast rules, but sort of sticking to the, listening to the voice inside your head that's saying, you know, you should really mulligan this. You just can't keep this.
We joke about it all the time. Sorry about that. With team events, right? Where, like, why are you asking about this hand? You know you're supposed to mulligan this hand. You just want me to tell you you're not supposed to so that you can justify your bad decision. And, like, the truth is that if I had Matt Kling looking over my shoulder at every hand, I would just be way better at mulliganing. And I think that's true of all of us.
Yeah, I mean, two heads are almost always better than one.
Well, it's not even that. I actually don't think the second hand actually matters.
Yeah, the judgment, yeah.
Yeah, I think that, like, I would just be ashamed at some of the hands that I keep. And that's bad. Like, there's no reason for me to feel that way, because at the end of the day, I'm just wrong. And I know I'm wrong. And I want to get lucky, because I don't want to go to five. And it's almost always on a six for me. And it's... The truth is that... And something that I constantly need to tell myself, with this is that, sorry, I know that everybody can hear my phone, my babysitter and my wife are having a conversation. I know that I can win with five, and I don't know what causes that disparity between my brain and what I know is right, Michael. What do you think it is that hits us as Magic players where we're so willing to sacrifice what we know is correct for one measly card?
I don't know. I mean, I sort of lead the other way. My vast preference is to keep sixes that look like they need to get there than to go to five. And I think that that's actually just 100% correct. I think going to five is something.
Oh, so maybe I'm right. Maybe I have no idea what I'm talking about here. And actually, Spencer's great at mulliganing.
I mean, it's so context and deck dependent. I think that it's actually impossible to say that you're just supposed to keep sixes because they look like they
can
get there.
Yeah. I mean,
it's true and limited basically all the time.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I was playing Boros today, so it wasn't true. I actually should go to five a lot on the play, but I think that in mulliganing specifically, when it was just me and Michael on the podcast, we actually hit this a lot. We said constantly that the number one thing you can do to win more matches of Magic is to become good at disciplined mulliganing. And I don't think that's changed. I think that so many times... Like, how many times have players said, I was so ashamed when they thought seized me? Like, that shouldn't be a thing. That's not a thing you should be able to say.
Well, I can tell you why people are more inclined to keep bad hands rather than mulliganing.
Go.
It's just because it feels so much worse to lose because you mulligan to three or four or whatever. Like, if you mulligan to Oblivion, it feels like you didn't get to play Magic. But
right.
The fact is, you're just not going to...
But you're not
going to
play Magic either way.
Well, it's not even that you won't necessarily play Magic. Like, sometimes you'll play games of Magic, but unless your opponent's hand is also not functional, then you're just going to lose. And it's there's no reason to, you know, prolong things if the deck is, you know, telling you yeah. You need a mulligan, you should just do it. And then if you lose because of it, I mean, sometimes you lose.
I think maybe the key is kind of separating if I keep a hand, it's because I think it's correct, not because I want to. It has been a long time since I kept a hand where I thought rationally I should mulligan it, but I wanted to keep it, so I just kept it.
Yeah, certainly not in a tournament. Absolutely. I've done that on Magic Online where I'm like, this hand is sweet. I'm definitely keeping it, but...
But, I mean, I think that's the kind of thing you have to get away from, ultimately. Like, if you look at a hand that maybe has to get there, I think this hand wins if I draw two lands. Sure, maybe that percentage call is correct, depending on...
I think that the thing that's important to recognize here, Michael, that you're saying, and that we should recognize, is the thing that we hit home about, or that Matt specifically has hit home about a lot, which is having a reason to make those kind of decisions. The yeah. reason to not want to mulligan to five is not a reason to not mulligan. The reason to not mulligan to five because you have... Right, exactly, because nobody wants to do that. That's a stupid reason. But the reason saying, like, well, actually... If I draw a land in my first two draw steps on the draw, I probably actually have a really good shot at winning this game. But being honest about that is really important too, right? Because I can say that. I can be like, if I draw a land, I'm fine. But, like, does my hand actually shape out that way? And that's kind of where the balance lies and where you have to be honest about mulliganing.
Right, definitely. And, I mean, like I said, you have to consider what deck you're playing. Like, there are plenty of decks where a mulligan to five is actually not a problem.
Right.
I mean, that's my biggest takeaway from how much Tron I've played is that if you're keeping bad sixes, you're just going to lose a lot of games.
Right. As somebody who's picked up Tron recently, I mulliganed a ton with that deck and had a ton of success. And the thing is, it's also true of Scapeshift in a way. You can mulligan a six all you want. Like, you should just actively be mulliganing to six with Scapeshift if you have even close to a not great hand. And that's actually, I'm going to reverse this, because I actually think that's just true in Magic. I think that the difference between 7 and 6 is not big enough that you should just not be mulliganing back 6s just every time. And
I honestly, I think outside of Limited, I'm mostly on the mulligan any 6 that doesn't look playable as well.
You mean 7, yeah, but yeah.
No, I meant 6. I'm mulliganing 6s that aren't playable. I am not afraid to go to 5 basically ever.
Yeah, I'm starting to get there. I think that the truth is that this is one of the biggest parts of Disciplined Magic, and that's why we just spent, 5 minutes on it. But I want to talk about two of the other things that kind of really apply to Magic here. And these kind of go back to our Patreon question, and I want to talk about thoughtful decision-making and playing the right lands. I had a game. It was SEG Salt Lake, and my opponent did something. And I had the counterspell that... I was playing Jeskai, and I had the counterspell with Overload. I don't remember what it's called. But basically, I tapped my lands incorrectly and lost the game because of it. And it was, like, kind of a horrible experience. Because I'm just 0% to lose that game, and I just tapped my lands correctly. And this is something that we do all the time, that we put so little thought into, that requires so little thought, but somehow we give it less than it needs. And one of the things that I have tried ever since then to do right is to tap and play the correct lands, because it doesn't take more thought than what could my draw step look like? How do I want this turn to play out? Continue.
Yeah, this is funny. Playing the right lands is one of the things that I'm not even necessarily sure that I get it right more often than most people, but it's something I definitely put a lot more thought into than most people. Like, basically any time that I'm, like, playing a shared league with somebody, like, if I'm Skyping with somebody through a league or, watching over their shoulder in person, my very first, the most interesting thing to me is always what land they play first. Because it's a huge option, right? Like, oftentimes you'll have, like, 4 lands in hand, and it's sometimes not clear which land to play first, so it honestly tells me a little bit about what they expect a game to look like and what they're okay with having happen to them. Because there are drawbacks and upsides to anything. But
yeah, we used to get into this a lot with cycling lands. Matt mostly wanting to play them, me mostly never wanting to play them. But I think that more than it being like, if it's like, well, I have a spell pierce and I accidentally played my planes, that's just a dumb mistake. But beyond that, I think just thinking critically about what you expect the game to look like, or just like having a reason to make the plays you're making, right? Like, if we're moving beyond the, oh, I accidentally played lands that, didn't give me the color combination I need, that kind of stuff, and into sort of like, there's actually debate here. I think that ultimately, I come back to this all the time, but if there's a thought process or a logic behind the play that I'm making, then the way to improve my game isn't to change my plays, it's to change my thought process.
Can we rewind, though? Because I actually think you skipped an important part, because I understand why you're saying what you're saying because of the level of Magic that you're at. I, even at the Pro Tour, had Plains, Swamp, white 2-drop, black 2-drop, any other number of cards. Okay? I'm on the play, and I play turn 1 Swamp, pass, untap, my opponent untaps, plays whatever they're going to do, I untap, draw a white card. This was Origins.
Right.
The white card was, whatever the white 2-drop that's insane is.
The renowned one that, like, pumps everything.
Yep, that's right, yeah. And
curious,
like,
if you'd been able to play at that turn,
I probably could have won my draft. Like, it was so bad that it's funny because contextually, it's like I'm looking at my hand, like, yeah, it doesn't matter which line I play. Get, you know, play this, go. And then, you know, I play my other 2-drop, it doesn't matter. But the truth is like, I actually had the most insane 2-drop in the, like, in the format in my deck, and I actually would have gone on to win that game had I been able to play that. And, you know, I think that even the best players have these moments of weakness when they don't think these things through properly.
Yeah, I mean, like, right now, Niv-Mizzet is probably the card that'll bite you the most often. And I think just being aware of it, it's trying to find the balance between, like, what's in your deck and what are you representing, right? So what value am I getting out of playing a different land for, you know, if I play a swamp and it represents a black spell, how much is it going to cost me if I can't play my Niv-Mizzet on time? Versus, you know, if it, what can I represent? What can I cast? What, and I think ultimately, like, what I would take away from that is we have to be aware of what decisions we're actually making. Because in that spot, what actually happens, right, is you're not making the decision you thought you were making.
Not at all. I thought the decision I was making didn't matter.
Right. So, and sometimes it doesn't, right? There are legitimately times where it doesn't matter, but I think being cognizant of what the actual costs of every play are is important, right? I mean, you pretty much always lose when you play something and then you're like, oh, I didn't think of that. That's never a good spot to be in.
It's true. I think that we've all been there, Matt, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was just going to say, it's even more interesting with the sequencing of lands with things like Niv-Mizzet right now. Because there's a pretty good chance you're going to have to squeeze in tap lands into your sequencing some amount of the time, too. So it's not like you can start thinking about it on turn 4 or 5 to cast this Niv-Mizzet. Sometimes you've got to start thinking about it a lot earlier than that. Like, if I end up with somehow, like, island, swamp, or mountain in play, and then all my red sources are tap lands from there on, like, now I'm not casting Niv-Mizzet until turn 7, even though I had the appropriate lands to do so.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think that ultimately, like, what your takeaways in these spots have to be is just trying to fully understand the trade-offs you're making. I think if you can get to the point where you're recognizing that there is a cost to either playing all your spells on curve because Niv-Mizzet is in your deck and you might not be able to play that on curve, or vice versa, right? If we can understand, you know, and the costs of whatever we choose to do, we're much more likely to correctly evaluate what the best choice is.
I think it just comes back to what you were saying before, which is, like, you know, taking an extra second, especially on the plays that you think are intuitive and the ones that you're just going to get right on autopilot. It's important to actually look at those lines and decide if this decision is actually going to impact the outcome of the game.
And Limited is more like that sometimes, just because you will, like, get into situations where you haven't necessarily played a ton of games with the same lists or the same cards, and things interact differently than you'd expected, and, you know, your mana is worse. Like, there are just often more little marginal calls in games of Limited.
I think that this really feeds into that next thing that I said, right, which is thoughtful decision-making is something that you can almost ignore when you're playing self-discipline, when you're not playing self-discipline Magic. It is this thing that I remember so clearly it has to be, like, Matt's second episode back with Manny, where he just talked about, I have played like 1,000 games of Magic this week. I'm sure he said 1,000. I'm sure it wasn't actually that. But you talked about how you had played all this Magic and you remembered 0 of the games. You're like, I actually have no idea what happened. Literally none. I have no idea what happened. And that's an extreme case, right? But the truth is that when you talk to some of the best players, you know, when I've talked to different players about their interactions that I respect, they just tell me exactly what happened. And it's impressive. It's like the reason that they're able to do that is because they thought about their decisions. Had they not been thinking about their decisions, they would just be like everybody else. They're like, I don't know, like, got mana screwed and kind of sucked. But, like, instead they're like, actually, this and this happened. Here's what I did. I think I was wrong here.
Yeah, I think, too, it's recognizing that, like, the marginal things cost you. One of the things that maybe is hardest to understand when you haven't played a lot of Magic is that being good at Magic isn't really about, like, making these really sick, flashy plays most of the time. It's, like, mulliganing well and, you know, not making your top deck Niv-Mizzet uncastable. And, like, when you play yourself to get lucky rather than super level your opponent.
And I think that so many people think about those leveling your opponents, those Jedi mind tricks. I mean, I think I've done two videos on this, and it's like you've got to stop. You don't even play the right land on turn one 30% of the time. Stop trying to, like, brain get your opponent. Like, you're not even close to there. And the reason that you think you're there is because you're winning 80% of your games against bad players. And you need to stop, and you need to focus on the little things so that when you go to play against a player that's equal or better than you, you actually have a shot. Other than the shot that Magic gives you by default, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I think that basically everybody has, like, an intuitive reaction to whatever they think the play is. Like, you're going to have a very first look at something and have an idea of what you want to do. And it's important to take a step back from that and not just immediately go with that play.
And that's, so, that's even though it's often really, correct.
It's really, it
no,
is
it is. It
correct
is often correct.
Not, but that's thoughtful decision-making in a nutshell.
You guys want to know an insane stat that kind of has to do with what you guys are saying, but tangentially? So there was a study done on first impressions of human beings. So humans have this natural reaction to just instantly think something about somebody from their first initial impression of them, right? So there's an intense study done on this. What percentage of the time is that initial reaction correct?
I already heard this from you, so.
Okay. Well, Michael.
I'll let Michael take a guess.
80%.
It is almost exactly 80% of the time you are correct. So, to be fair, 20% of the time, you're a scumbag, and you think something horrible about somebody you shouldn't think, but 80% of the time, you're correct. And, you know, I think that we need to, it is, in Magic, for example, it is more important to recognize the 20% of times where you just thought something and did it, rather than the 80% of the times where you thought something and were correct. Because anyone can do that. That's just human nature. It is your job as a Magic player and as a human to adjust to those, to that large percentage of times, to be honest. That's, you know, 1 in 5 times you're wrong. Taking every single one of those as a chance to improve.
Yeah, and it's not about never making mistakes, right? It's about slowly weeding them out by improving your decision-making process. I think that that's an important distinction, that, like, if every play you make is for a reason, and every hand you keep is for a reason, and every land you play, you know, if everything you're doing is reasoned, then you have the chance to improve from the plays you make, because you're just going to be able to look back at those plays and analyze your thought process critically.
I think that it's so, what's the word, self-prophecy? No. Basically, because you're right about that kind of stuff so often, it's easy to think that the times that you're wrong is you being unlucky. But the fact is that you are going to be wrong 1 in 5 times about stuff like this. That's just human nature, and we need to minimize that while also knowing the times when we're going to be correct, right? If you hear LSV talk on limited resources, for example, about him playing Magic, he plays a lot on intuition. And there's lots of players that do that. I do that probably too often. And the thing is that those moments where you correct yourself and you focus and you have a reason for what you're doing other than just intuition are pretty big moments, Matt.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's you know, one of the things that I continually try to work on. And I mean, I've talked about this a number of times on the podcast. But I think it's important to, you know, reflect on your decisions before you make them.
You know, this is honestly something that Hearthstone taught me in playing aggro decks, because I play almost mono aggro decks on Hearthstone. Beast Hunter, Odd Paladin, some number of aggro rogue decks, is it's really easy to autopilot those decks, right? But the terms that are important with a deck like Odd Paladin, for example, also, I'm sorry to everybody who doesn't play Hearthstone, has no idea what I'm talking about, but, like, the important turns are actually, like, what your opponent could have, and then playing around that in Odd Paladin, like, just shoots your win percentage up a pretty significant amount. And you can just autopilot and probably win a large percentage of your game in the low ranks at Odd Paladin. Matt tells me that all the time. The games that you're going to win the most are going to be games where you understand what your opponent's deck is doing, correctly identify it by, like, the cards that they play turns, like, 1 through 3, because that's actually how you identify decks in Hearthstone, and then playing accordingly. To be honest, Matt, you actually taught me a lot of this in our times talking about things like Odd Paladin and Beast Hunter.
Sweet. I'm glad that I could impart that upon you.
But I think that, like, I think that those lessons apply to Magic in significant ways. I can just go play one drop hero activation, three drop five mana card is in my hand. It actually doesn't matter, not Paladin. But basically, you just win the game 100% of the time when you do that, and your opponent doesn't interact. But the important thing is to know, like, how your opponent can interact on those turns, and that's true of other decks in Magic the Gathering, too. And when you just go on autopilot and you don't have thoughtful decisions in the lands you're playing, in the cards you're playing, why you're playing them, then you get taken advantage of pretty often, Michael.
Yeah, I think, and it just comes, like, one of the things that happens a lot is, based on what your opponent plays or doesn't play, you have to think about what's in their hand, what they could have kept. The secret is, if they kept something terrible, they'll usually just lose because their hand is terrible. So, you know, you mostly assume that your opponent kept something reasonable and trying to figure out, you know, okay, based on the way that they've played so far, what are they representing? Are they, you know, is this thing they're trying to represent? Is there a way I can draw more information without getting blown out? Like, what is going on my opponent's side of the table? And I think that then trying to reflect that in your own play can take you from being basically, like, you can get really proficient at sort of goldfishing a deck, understanding, like, when you're supposed to leave up mana to interact with your opponent, when you're not. But going beyond that to, like, I think they have this specific card in their hand based on how they've played, or I think, you know, when we get beyond just, like, tapping your lands correctly and, you know, deciding when to hold up what counterspell and when to play cards to the board, like, if they had this card, would they have played it? Are their cards stranded in their hand that only makes sense if it's, you know, this, like, comes up a lot. And I think just sort of trying to be aware of, like, bigger picture play patterns, rather than just, like, on this turn I play this, on this turn I play this, but critically thinking about the specific game you're playing. And that kind of sounds like the same thing, right? That rather than just playing, like, rather than just maximizing damage, you're trying to decide, I think my opponent has Deafening Clarion, or I think my opponent only has spot removal.
Well, I mean, going the other way, I mean, it makes sense to play around things on curve, right? Like, you're not going to play a bunch of X1s into a turn 3 against a deck playing Goblin Chainwhirler, right?
Right.
So, like, it certainly makes, I mean, it's the same way you play Odd Paladin, right? You're like, I'm not going to play into, you know, whatever the wrath is that my opponent happens to be playing on that turn. And yeah, the same is true of Magic. It's worth thinking about the most common cards on curve, right? Like, I'm not gonna play something into a Glorybringer or whatever.
That's kind of what I was saying with the Hearthstone thing, is that in Hearthstone the card pool is a lot smaller, and, like, the playable card pool is actually significantly smaller. And so because of that, it actually taught me about thinking about on curve plays better than Magic ever did.
Absolutely. I don't know that I did this basically ever before I started playing Hearthstone, and now I do it basically all the time. So,
and this happens a lot, like, if your opponent is, say, maybe representing a Glimmer of Genius, right, you might try to save a spell that you would rather them have to act on for
Chemist's Insight now, but
sure, but it's the idea, right? Like,
I'm just trying to help all the listeners here, Michael.
If you want you have a surprising amount of agency over what your opponent is able to play,
or what they would want to play, even more specifically, right?
Well, exactly, right? Like, if you play a card they have to counter, then they're going to have to counter it. And, you know, if you play a card that proactively blanks a Teferi versus one that does, like, you just, a lot of the time your cards will do different things depending on how and when you play them. And I think recognizing that your cards are more than just sort of goldfishing instruments no matter which side of the matchup you're playing, it can really take you from like playing relatively low mistake magic to playing actually good magic.
So I'd like to move on from this, you know, what this thoughtful decision making into, first of all, I wanted to specifically hit on unnecessary risks, because this cost me a Pro Tour invite not even, what is it, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, where I was frustrated with my hand. It's game three, qualifying for a Pro Tour. I'm like, you know what, whatever. Like, you would have to top deck three cards in a row to beat me. I'm just going to cast this, this Settle the Wreckage. Good luck. I think I was at 23 at the time. My opponent goes, top deck, Chandra, play it, activate, top deck, thing, play it, untap. After I kill the Chandra, top deck, thing, and I'm like, oh, actually, I do lose to that. Yep, that happened. And the truth is, like, I could have actually just taken that 5 damage, drawn a land in 2 turns, and just won the game, qualified for the Pro Tour, gone with, like, my best friend Quentin, and it would have been over. And the thing is it's really easy for me to say, I got unlucky in that, right? My opponent got insanely lucky. That's not actually what happened. I didn't have to do that. I got frustrated, I got excited about qualifying for a Pro Tour, and I let that get the better end of me, which is something that Michael talked about earlier in this episode, this letting your emotions get involved. Even the definition of this self-discipline is to not let that happen. And I let that moment of qualifying for the Pro Tour get the better of me, Matt. Like, why did I do that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely managing your emotions is a huge part of Magic. I mean, you're just going to make better decisions if you're more level-headed. That's just true all the time.
I mean, you actually played FPSs professionally, and I would assume that's even more true there.
Yeah, I mean, certainly anytime you go on Tilty, it's just going to make you play badly. It's not, I wouldn't even say that it's more true than it is in Magic. I think that you're given a little bit of separation in Magic where you're not having to make decisions every single second, so you do have a little bit more time to think, which helps. But I mean, just being, you know, upset is going to make you do anything poorly.
Michael, we don't have to use me as an example, but you know, you've had a lot of matches to qualify for a Pro Tour, and you know, I've seen you take risks when they were appropriate. Specifically, I think you were playing against Brandon, where I watched you take a couple of risks that were, I mean, it made a lot of sense. I've seen you not have to take any risks and just play it safe for a few Pro Tour invites. Like, how do you manage emotions versus risks, reward? Like, how does that all shake out for you?
I think, so when I go to, like, your example, or really, I mean, whether you're playing well or poorly, right, I think a lot of the time...
Can I clarify that I was playing the best Magic I've ever played in my life up until that point?
But let's say you're really far behind, right? And you decide, let's say your opponent says in that spot, the only way I can win this game is if he decides to cast Settle the Wreckage. So rather than making a conservative attack into a Settle the Wreckage, I'm going to attack with everything, right? Because maybe he knows that the only way he can win is to just like top deck like a savage from there, right? Yeah. And I think that like... games like that before where it works out. And I think that ultimately what you have to do is like in games where, whether you're ahead or behind, you're just trying to identify what is a necessary risk versus what is an unnecessary risk, right? Like, and obviously he would rather have creatures in play than not have creatures in play. Yeah. But if the only way he can win is for you to cast Settle the Wreckage, then he has to incentivize you to cast Settle the Wreckage as much as he possibly can.
And we should clarify, like, the reason this is important is because I was on 6 lands. Had I been on 7 lands, it wouldn't have mattered. I just would have won. So I just needed to draw that 7th land, and the game was over. I had multiple turns to draw that land due to my life total. I had plenty of time to, like, untap multiple times. And because I sequenced the way I did, I eventually had to play a 5-mana angel off of curve without counterspell backup and things like that. And, you know, it goes to show you that when you make one bad decision, it might force you to play, to have bad plays happen throughout the rest of the game. And so understanding, like, where am I at in this game? Why am I making the decision that I'm making right now? And is it reasonable? Does it matter? Like, what happens in the next three turns if I don't make this decision is not... It doesn't take that long. You've probably played a lot of Magic with the deck that you're playing, and it's important to focus on, well, okay, where am I at now, and where will I be in 5 minutes?
I think sort of understanding if status quo is favoring you or not, right? Like, if we both just kind of, like... If we both make plays that are sort of board neutral from here, who's winning? Right? Like, am I the one who needs things to break their way and I need to make the aggressive, risky play? Or is my opponent trying to get me to make an aggressive, risky play because that's the only way they can win?
Matt, why is this important to you? Like, how has this impacted you in your Magic career?
Well, I mean, as far as, like... Why is what important to me? Sorry.
The whole thing. Like, why is disciplined Magic... Where has that impacted you and why?
Well, like I said, I always try to keep myself as level as possible. I think that it's going to impact every part of your game. I mean, I certainly don't find myself to be mistake-free in those ways even. It's just, you know, we try to get better every week. I think it's important because if we're not making disciplined plays, then, you know, what are we doing? We're just throwing cards against each other.
Yeah, I mean, eventually, I mean, this is actually something that I kind of tweeted about this week, but I plan on doing a video on it eventually, but I actually think that Magic players have gotten obsessed with their matchups across the board when they pick decks to, like, a kind of a negative part on them, where they so much focus on their win percentages with the decks versus the field that they actually don't focus enough on game-in and game-out interactions and playing correctly and doing the right things the highest percentage of the time, because they're like, I mean, my deck has a good matchup, so I'll probably just win.
Yeah, and I mean, it's important to note that if you're going to, you know, do well in any major event, you're going to have to win some bad matchups too.
Absolutely, and I think that sometimes we don't do that enough.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Michael, what about you? How does this resonate with you as a Magic player?
Well, I think that just, like, a lot of my background in education and things like that are related to process improvement. And I think that if I can approach Magic from a similar standpoint, that, like, if we think about what we're doing, then we can critique ourselves. And if we're able to critique ourselves and our plays and even our, you know, deck building process or our drafting, like, it, this is something you can do in every aspect of your life, but every aspect of Magic as well, right? If you're able to evaluate what's going well and poorly for you, you're a lot more likely to be able to figure out why it's going well and poorly for you. And then from there, move on to sort of, you know, okay, how do I improve this? What are other people doing that I'm not? And I think just trying to be willing, it's hard to learn if you're not being thoughtful.
Matt, is there any... I like how I said Matt with an I there, because, you know, I'm incapable of speaking. But, you know, how do you see yourself finding these mistakes for yourself? Like, when do you catch yourself the most often not playing this type of Magic?
Well, most of the time when I'm not playing this type of Magic is on, you know, Magic Online, just grinding through leagues. But, I mean, it's happened to me at many places. I mean, just at the last RPTQ that I played... I definitely lost round one because I just forgot that there was a Cuts Ribbons in his graveyard.
Oh, it's, man, like, that's the worst feeling.
Yeah, it's not a mistake that I needed to make. It was just I got so confident because I was so far ahead in the game. That's another time I'll find myself making these kind of mistakes, is when I'm so far ahead that I have to really think hard on which ways that I could possibly lose. I almost always play better from behind than I do from ahead.
This is actually something we had. We had Josh Erlayton at Oasis Games a while back. And I actually asked him, I said, what is the one thing that I can do to really improve at Magic? And he said, you need to, like, no matter who you are as a Magic player, we don't do enough as Magic players to learn to play from ahead. Josh is like, we all need to do that. That is something that I pride myself in. That's something my playtesting team prides me in. Like, that's something we need to do as Magic players. Also, this is not a direct quote. He said it differently than I just said it. But it was a big takeaway for me, Michael. Like, learning to play from ahead is important. And as we just talked about with my example of not qualifying for the Pro Tour, I was so far ahead. And I just let the game get away from me because I just wanted to win right now. I wanted to qualify for the Super Pro Tour right now so bad that I let it get away from me.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's easy to not be as in touch with kind of your opponent's outs and what's in your opponent's deck and what your opponent is trying to do in a game. Especially when you're ahead and you feel like things are kind of breaking your way. I would say for me, the biggest times I find myself making mistakes is when I am too tethered to sort of heuristics. Like I have a good read on my opponent for having a card, but feel like I should just make a play anyways because it's like more correct in a vacuum. I don't know if
it makes a lot of sense, right? Like
very well, but
the number of times where you think something because you've done it 12 times, you know, which. By the way, I say 12, and it's like, oh, that's not that many. But it's like, no, like, I've been in this situation 14 times. 12 of them I did this. It was correct all of those times. Like, I'm just going to do this. And it's hard. It's hard not to get caught in that trap that Michael's talking about. And I think you're right, Michael. I think that is everyone's biggest weakness.
It's really hard to break from. And I think part of this and part of wanting to learn is not being afraid to look stupid. Don't be afraid to make weird plays if you have a reason for them. Don't be afraid to like play things off curve. Don't be afraid to, if you make a game about playing Magic and not just lining cards up and slamming them into each other, I think you have a lot more ability to leverage critical thinking skills.
I want to add to that because I think that the key that I would say to this is to not be afraid. You know, I was going to ask people for tips and tricks for the end of this for our listeners, but I think that the biggest tip is what Michael's saying. Like, don't be afraid to look foolish. Like, you have a search for tomorrow, put a test on top of your deck. It doesn't matter what the suspend card is. Like, remember to remove that suspend counter, put a dice on top of your deck. If you have an upkeep trigger, the same thing. You know, whatever you need to do to maximize your win percentage, personally, like, how you need to play Discipline Magic, do those things. Don't worry what the other person thinks. The end of the result is, like, the thing that matters here. It doesn't matter if your opponent's like, my opponent's so dumb, they had to remember their pack trigger. It's like, well, did you remember it? Because if you didn't, you weren't playing Discipline Magic. So, like, do whatever you need to do to remember the fact that you just passed that summoner's pact. And that's the end of the story. That's the things that you need to do. Figure out what it is and do it. Because that's going to give you the best percentage to win compared to almost anything. I mean, we talked about some of the biggest things in Magic today, Michael. We talked about mulligans. We talked about thoughtful decision-making. We talked about, you know, remembering the little things. Like, this episode really encapsulates what it takes to gain those small percentage points if you do it right 100 times.
And I think even, like, what I really mean when I say don't be afraid to look stupid, I don't really care if I mulligan to 3, I don't really care if I mulligan to 6 and keep a 1-lander and never draw a second. Like, just, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in the sense that, like, some ways are worse to lose than others, right? You make the plays that you think maximize your win percentage, and even if sometimes it looks really stupid, it, you know, if there's a reason you think what you think, roll with it.
I completely agree. Well, you can support this podcast directly by going to patreon.com/ccmtg. If you join the Patreon right now, by the time that Seth and John get here, if you're a patron, you're going to be entered into a couple of contests to win boxes of Magic cards as well as an entire set of a card of your choice in Standard. You can find me at Specific13H. You can find Matt at The Witch Clean. You can find Michael at MagicMikeMTG. And you can find the podcast at CCMTG on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook at The Constructive Criticism, or just Constructive Criticism. You can join the Constructive Criticism family. And, you know, I think that this is one of my favorite episodes. Like, I honestly am so excited for the listeners to hear this and just recognize that, you know, Matt talks about the same thing that I've talked about learning in Hearthstone. Michael's talking about those micro decisions. And I think that for a lot of our listeners, this is the moment where they're winning PPTQs, but they're not tapping RPTQs, and they're not sure why. And I think that just understanding that your job as a Magic player, if you want to win as many games as possible, is just to do this. Like, play disciplined Magic. Do the things that you know you're supposed to do, and then adjust from there. And I think that's really cool. You can join the conversation on the Contractors and Family. You can join the Discord. I'm going to just do this on the show. Just because I'm horrible. Hey Siri, set a reminder to post the Discord on our About page. Done. she's going to ask me when to do it. But I'm going to remember just from that. I'm edited this out. I don't know. But I'm really horrible. I said that I would do it for 3 weeks. We have a Discord. I'll do it. I'm sorry, Matt. Matt, I'm sorry to you.
Why are you sorry to me?
I don't know. I just need to apologize for somebody for not doing it. It is in the show notes the last 2 weeks, though. So, you know, join that Discord. We talk about, you know, anime. We talk about books. We talk about everything. It's just a nerd culture thing that people really are enjoying. It's really fun. So, you know, check that out. Hashtag would that be good? It's no longer, so I don't know why it's in the show notes. But, you know, Michael is disconnected, so... So there's some technical difficulties. They actually, if you're watching live, you probably got to see. But you know, something that I learned this week is just that we all have moments of weakness in all of this, and I want to be better at them tomorrow than I was today. This is the perfect Always Improving episode. So I want to thank all the listeners for, you know, doing the show with us and improving every week with us. Thank you so much. We're going to go because Michael's gone. But, you know, we'll see you guys all next week with another episode of Constructive Criticism.
Thanks, guys.
Magic.